The following Aloud podcast was recorded live in 2008 at the historic Central Library in the heart of downtown LA as part of the award-winning Aloud series presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Aloud podcasts are made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arent Fox and by individual contributions from listeners like you. For more information on Aloud, or to find out how you, too, can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please visit our website, www.aloudla.org.
Good afternoon. I'm Dinah Lenny. Thank you all for coming on this very beautiful Sunday. I've really enjoyed... can you hear me? Yeah, you see they can hear me. I've really enjoyed reading Lisa's and Nina's books over the last few months. I had a really wonderful summer with these books. It occurred to me, I was in the green room just now, and I thought I would ask them, I thought I'd wait and ask them with you, if they were surprised initially to be put together in conversation. Their fiction is ostensibly very different, but there are lots of similar themes, and I thought I'd ask each of you to talk about that a little bit.
I was flattered. that was the first response. Like, wow, I'm honored to be on the stage with you, and that was really, you know, what I felt. Surprised in the sense that you know, I read a lot about Los Angeles. You know, Lisa's last couple of books have been set in China, but I think that we have some biographical things that are in common, but the main thing is that we both really incorporate history, and that also history in a way that isn't just static in itself, but that I think in some way reflects on the present. And so I think in those concerns, it kind of made sense to me.
And how about you?
Yeah, well, I was just delighted because you're such a fabulous writer, first of all. And I thought, especially when I was reading The Age of Dreaming, that combination, just as you said, of history, but also I think our shared backgrounds being raised in bicultural, biracial families, and how you have integrated that into your work is, I think, quite similar, actually, to the same way that I have. And I you know, I don't get to meet many people who do that, so it's fun.
Yeah, it's interesting that you both write from the point of view of not from the Caucasian sides of your families, but from this in your case, you're often writing from this Japanese point of view, and you from a Chinese point of view. So first of all, how much of the inspiration comes from your personal upbringing, and how much of it comes from history? How much is it coming out of research?
How do you mean?
I mean, initially writing about, was it?
I can answer this.
Good,
if you like.
Thank
good.
You.
Good, you start. Then it may help me think.
Give you a second.
Well, it kind of depends. You know, there's a couple of questions there. One is your concept of other. You know, I was born in Japan.
Right.
I was raised in a Japanese family. My parents divorced, but my mother remarried a Japanese man. So other to me, living in Japan, was not Japanese. It was American and white. And so she, you know, when she moved here, it's really interesting to her to look at Japanese Americans or people of color in general and say, you know, why do people feel so, you know, insecure or strange or whatever? You know, I am the majority.
Uh-huh.
She doesn't see herself as a minority. So there's some, you know, it's kind of an interesting question of what is other and what is what.
But
is
what
norm.
Would you say has formed your notions about who you are?
Sure. I think that it's partly that, you know, that the first several, you know, racial identity is not formed, you know, in the last 5 years for me, in my 30s. It was formed from early experience. In my first few years, I spent in Japan. Japanese was my first language. And so that's who I saw and what I was around. And then when I did move to the United States, I initially moved to a very white Midwest environment, a small town in Wisconsin, where I was the only kid of color. Didn't speak English. You know, was very foreign to everybody. And in that situation, you know, and had a very hard time. So in that situation, you know, not only would it have been bizarre to identify with the kind of people who were beating me up every day,
uh-huh.
It would have been self-destructive. You know, so I think that went a long way towards in a very early, at an early time, for me, setting my identity.
And so can we stay on this?
Please.
So on this first part of the question, I think for me, you know, for all of us, how do we identify ourselves? It's by the people that you see around you, especially when you're a child. They're your mirror. And so I grew up here in Los Angeles. I spent a lot of time in Los Angeles Chinatown. I have a very large family here, about 400 relatives, of which there are about a dozen that look like me. The majority are still full Chinese, and then there's this spectrum in between. And so, again, you know, this was a very traditional Chinese-American family, for all the good parts and the bad parts of that. And so I think... you know, obviously I look the way I do, right? So I can't get around that either. And so in many ways, I identified with this Chinese part, and yet I know I will never be completely accepted in Los Angeles Chinatown because I don't look like I belong there. When I go to China, I get it, I understand it. To me, it's just a larger version of Chinatown. And yet, because of how I look, I'll never be completely accepted there. Then, now, you know, you go out and lately I've been going on these big tours across the country, and you're out there in a place like Wisconsin, and, you know, I look like I belong. But there are a lot of times where I just don't get it. I mean, I just don't get it. And so I think that that sense, I don't know that it's being the other, it's just not quite fitting in here and not quite fitting in there. And so for me, a lot of what I'm doing with the writing has to do with that. Where do I fit in? What do I know? What do I not know? These questions aren't being answered in the books. Uh-huh. They're not what the books are about, but it's just a journey I'm on.
And how much... Well, why don't you talk a little bit about how research is involved in the writing of these books? For instance, you were propelled back into the history of Los Angeles. Lisa, you're writing a lot about Chinese history. Why was that compelling to you? What sent you off in those directions?
Well, for me, a lot of the time, it's just if I hear about something, I've got to know more. With Peony and Love... was a little different. This takes place in the mid-17th century in the Yangtze Delta. These women who loved a Chinese opera called the Peony Pavilion, they were never allowed to see it. They could only read it. And when they did, they would catch cases of lovesickness and waste away and die. And as they were dying, they would write poems and stories, which were then published after their death. So this book is based on the true story of three of these lovesick maidens who were all married to the same man, one right after the other, who wrote the first book of its kind to have been written and published anywhere in the world by women. And there's a ghost. Okay? And there's a lot of death. And so I felt like I knew quite a bit about death in the Chinese culture. I mean, if you have a big family, you're going to have a lot of people dying. And I've been to many, many, many Chinese funerals. And there are certain traditions, just like with any tradition where you have whatever, you know, you have these certain traditions that are attached. And I just did them just like we all do them, whatever it is. You just do it. You don't really think much about it. But when I was going to be writing about death and burials and ghosts, then I had to know much, much more. So... along the way, I got to discover sort of, well, now I know why we get candy at a funeral. Oh, now I understand why we give money. You know, so those kinds of things. So it's sort of taking what I know, but then trying to understand what's deeper.
And digging. Deep digging.
And then the more you find, the more you just think, oh, wow. And so there was one point when I was at UCLA just doing this research on burial practices, and I came across ghost weddings, and I thought, oh my God, I've got to have one of those.
and Nina, what compelled you about the history of Los Angeles?
Well, I think a couple of things. When I wrote, my first book is a little bit more contemporary. My second book starts in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and takes place largely in the Crenshaw district of LA. And the main thing was that when I started writing it, I was living in upstate New York, which is about as far away as you can get from Los Angeles and still be in America. And I was desperately homesick. And I was also really falling in love with LA in a way that I didn't feel necessarily when I lived here. You know, it was easier for me to write about the city when I was away from it. It kind of like writing a love letter. You know, you can't write a love poem about someone when you're in the same room with them. You know, you've got to be pining for them. So there was that. But as I started to learn a little bit more about Los Angeles, I was amazed at what I grew up here, was amazed at what I had not been taught, because we're really led to believe that LA has no history, that any history that it does have is related to the movie industry, and that there's just nothing of value worth remembering or telling. And to me, there actually is a fascinating history here. It's often, though, in the lives of families and people and communities. And so when I started to learn some of these things, like you know, the fact that Santa Monica Beach used to be segregated, there used to be a fence, you know, going down separating the colored side from the white side, or that right here in downtown LA, Little Tokyo, when it emptied out, when the Japanese Americans were sent to the internment camps, filled up with Southern black migrants and was called Bronzeville. Yeah. You know, and that was just fascinating stuff to me, and I really wanted to recover it. And I think also in a more personal sense, I grew up here in Culver City, and my social group was very much largely black and Japanese American. And even though that was perfectly natural to us, it was sometimes frowned upon by our parents, for whom such cross-racial friendships were not, you know, so kosher to completely mix, you know, cultures here. So I found this place called the Holiday Bowl, which has since been destroyed, which was this wonderful gathering place of elderly folks of all races, but particularly Japanese American and African American. And you know, the menu reflected the customers. You could get jambalaya and sushi at the same place. And when I found these people in their 70s, and I realized I just said elderly, and there's people here who were probably older than, you know, not elderly, everyone is young, but folks who were my grandparents' age. So when we saw, you know, 70-year-old black folk hang out with 70-year-old Japanese folks, that for me was like finding my own family. And I wanted to explore what it was that allowed such a community to spring up in a city and in a country where, you know, kind of organic multiracial relationships are still, unfortunately, rare.
So identifying as you do, having, and I think you said that very well, Lisa, in terms of it's not a question of being other, it's a question of where you're comfortable and sort of finding your balance. It seems to me, having read a lot of this work now, that neither one of you is identifying with the white side of the family at this particular time anyway. Is it less compelling to you? Is that history a history that you take for granted? Is it something that you think you might get to when you've exhausted the other?
Well, for me, it's just this very personal thing, and it actually sort of goes back to what you were just talking about, that has to do with the love of people and places that have disappeared from my life. I just have finished a new book. It's not out yet. And it's very much sort of a love letter, in a sense, to Los Angeles, Chinatown, and to these people who are gone. And one of the great things about writing is that you can be with people that are gone day after day after day after day. And when I was editing Peony in Love, I realized that I have a character, a woman character, who has shown up in every single book I've written. She's the neighborhood committee director in The Mysteries. She was Madame Wong, the matchmaker, in Snowflower and the Secret Fan. She's the grandmother in Peony in Love, and she's the mother-in-law in the new book, Shanghai Girls. That this character, and she, you know, she looks different, she's in different countries, she's got different jobs, but it's this same character who really, at heart, is my grandmother, my great aunts, these women who I loved and who really helped to make me who I am. Mm-hmm. And so in writing this character and her different guises, I get to be with them every day.
I saw you nodding. Do you want to add to that?
That's so beautifully put, and I think that's exactly, you know, I have similar kind of archetypal characters that appear over and over, which for me I realize is a grandfather figure. You know, there's a strong father figure in my first book. There's the grandfather in my second book, who's kind of the center of the book, even though the protagonist is a young woman. And then the narrator of my, you know, The Age of Dreaming basically is, you know, grandfatherly age. And then my new book, we were kind of holding back what our new books were about, but is much more explicitly about a grandfather. So
yeah, let's talk about this for a minute, because both of you do write very effectively, I think, from this, for lack of a better word, elderly point of view. And I'm interested to know...
I'm glad you said it this time.
Yeah, I said it. And I am elderly. So there you go. But anyway, I mean, in terms of... I'm interested to know how that... as an actor, myself, you know, sort of how this role, playing this role in your work... affects you day to day? How does it inform your lives? And how do you, where do these voices come from? Now, Lisa, you've said that you knew these women intimately, and you too, these relationships, but how difficult is it to inhabit this role? Perhaps, could we, maybe this is the moment when you could maybe read a little bit. Are either one of you reading this character that shows up?
I wasn't.
Dang. Okay. Okay.
And actually, you know, the main character in this book is 16.
Right.
So, but she's a ghost, and she lives a very long time, you know,
and
she grows and she learns and she.
And there are a multitude of characters here, and you speak very well in all of their voices.
Thank you.
This is the thing that's fascinating to me about fiction, is that you are able to inhabit many different voices. So tell me about these old people for you, Nina.
Well, I guess there's a lot from the point of view, but not the voice of the grandfather in the second book. The third book is told in the first person voice of a 73-year-old guy, and you know, it's all I can say is that I was feeling a lot like a crusty old man when I wrote it, and I have been accused more than once in my life of being a crusty old man. So I mean, I know that's not what you see when you look at me, but it's
not at all, not remotely, no.
But it is a, you know, grumpy older gentlemen are very familiar and very dear to me. You know, I was raised by a single dad, as I was telling you, who's now 72, and my grandfather, my real grandfather, was you know, the kind of my hero. So it was very, you know, it wasn't that much of a reach for me to, you know, to kind of see the world from their point of view. But really, this character in this book to me is very much, it's not my father or my grandfather. It really is myself in a way, and that it's, in a lot of ways, this is the most autobiographical story I've told. But it's almost easier sometimes to put more of yourself into a character that appears to be very different from you. Whether it's that, you know, on the surface their, you know, biological, you know, their age or their gender appears to be different, or maybe, you know, what century they appear in. In a way, to me, that is easier. It's easier to put more of myself in that than if I were writing from a protagonist point of view that looks exactly, you know, that fits my profile.
So not to harp on this, I want to get back to this business of writing in different voices about themes that concern us now, but not to harp on this, but your father was in fact white, yes? Mm-hmm. So, and yet you're not...
He thinks he's Japanese, though.
He does.
Yes.
Nina, will you read a little bit to us?
Sure, please? But Lisa didn't get to answer the question.
Yeah, I didn't get to answer the
question. Lisa, answer my question first and then.
Okay. We were talking back here about getting older.
Yes.
And what, you know, were there any benefits to being over 50? And
we disagreed.
We disagreed on certain things.
But I'm in a mood.
She's not 50 yet, but some others of us up here are over 50. And I think that the older that you get, the more you have regrets, the more that you can look back on your life and realize the things that didn't work the way you wanted them to work, mm-hmm. or you didn't. We like to think that we all do the right thing, but maybe we didn't do the right thing. And I have, in writing, you know, because I do write about history, I have interviewed so many people who are in their 70s, 80s, 90s. And to a person, they have all had regrets. And in the earlier part of my career, I didn't really understand it, but now, now that I'm over 50, I do. I really do. And I wonder, you know, are there ways that you can fix these regrets and do it in a meaningful way? And I know with Snowflower and the Secret Fan, that was written from, you know, Lily's perspective, a woman who was 80. And in so many ways, that book, to me, was a way to try, in a kind of metaphysical way, to heal some of the regrets of the people that I have known and who have meant a lot to me in my life.
That makes a lot of sense to me, because I do think both of you write about redemption, about the redeeming your characters. And I want to ask you about the role of art versus relationships in the lives of these characters. It's interesting to me that in both, certainly in The Age of Dreaming, this is a book about a man who was an actor, who was very compelled by his acting career. And in both Peony and Love and Snowflower and the Secret Fan, we have women making art. A secret. In the case of Snowflower and mm-hmm. the Secret Fan, it's about writing, the joys and the healing properties of writing, and certainly in Peony and Love, it's much the same thing. This is about women who write this first book,
right? But also, you know, sort of the damage that art can cause. I mean, really, it's about that. You know, the wonderful things that can come out of creating art, but also the incredible harm.
Would you say that's true of your book as well? That character, John.
I mean, I felt so.
Yes,
I think so too.
Yeah, and I mean, I thought about. I'm not sure. Yes, my books are all concerned, all of them, with. You don't have to be 50 to feel regret. My first book was, I think, you know, I was still in my 20s, and that's all about regret. So it's that's. So it gets worse.
Yeah.
God, no. That part gets better.
I can't take it.
That part gets better.
But what was the question again?
I wanted you to talk about redemption.
Yes, there is the possibility for redemption in all of the books, but whether or not people can achieve it differs by book.
Right.
You know, this for me has a relatively happy ending.
It does.
And that's not necessarily always the case. But I do think that you know, talking specifically about this book, June's possibility for redemption ends up ultimately not being through art.
Right.
It ends up being through life. And in fact, in some way, he has to turn away from art, or turn away from art that would have been a huge compromise for him. In order to do the right thing in life. So I'm not sure that you can reach redemption. You know, if you've done some really screwed up things in your life and hurt people, you know, writing, doing something artistic is not going to help those people. It's probably going to piss them off. You know, like that you might feel better, but that is not enough. Like to redeem, you know, sins in life, I think they've got to be. And I use that word sin because I deal with it a lot in the new thing that I've just done. You can't, art is not going to fix it. Like, you've got to do something real to fix it, or so I believe.
And of course, the wonderful irony here is that you've written a book, you've made a piece of art about how art is not the redemptive, you know, prescription.
Well,
so that's interesting.
This book, I think, in a way, though, it, on a totally different level, came, and I was just talking about this earlier, because we came from another thing, but that, for me, this particular book was redemptive for a whole different reason, which is that I had such trouble getting my last book published. And it really came out of the sense of failure of not being able to sell that book. And, you know, there's no way that you can go through that experience and not have it affect your self-esteem and, you know, your senses as a writer, etc. So being able to sit down and start another work, even though you think that you might never be published again, for me, the act of even being able to sit down and write the book was redemptive. But only, you know, art only redeemed art for me. It didn't redeem life, if that makes sense.
Why don't you read a little bit to us, both of you? I'd love to hear just a little bit.
Okay, all right. This is, I'm going to read just the first page and a sentence. This novels about a former silent film star named Jun Nakayama, who's living in obscurity in the 1960s until he's found by a young journalist who wants to write a story about him, but also has a part for him in a movie that he's written. And so Jun is this kind of crusty, forgotten guy, and then this starts at the beginning, 1964. When I heard about the opening of the silent movie theater, I should have known that someone would look for me. But the young man's phone call yesterday morning was still a surprise. He found me the easy way by calling the operator, and the fact that my number is listed under my own real name is some measure of how rarely I've received such calls in the course of the last 40 years. Yesterday morning, for example, when the telephone rang, I expected the caller to be Mrs. Bradford from the townhouses down the street. We often take breakfast together on weekend mornings, a practice that has become more frequent since her husband passed away. And I wasn't prepared for the young, unfamiliar voice which asked, "Excuse me, sir, but are you the Jun Nakayama from the classic silent movie, Sleight of Hand?" I was caught off guard and asked curtly how he had come to possess my number. "My name is Nick Bellinger," the young man said, undaunted. "I'm an advisor to the people who are opening the new silent movie theater. They've been trying to figure out what films to show. They don't know much about the silence except for Fairbanks and Chaplin. And when I suggested your films, I'm a huge fan, by the way, it occurred to me that I didn't know what happened to you. I mean, if it really is you. I figured you might still be around somewhere, and on a whim, I just dialed information." By the time he finished, I'd gathered myself again, and I said as sternly as I could manage to, without appearing rude, "Young man, this is a private residence, and my number is not for public use. Please don't call again. I no longer give interviews." I realized my mistake when the caller exclaimed, "So you really are Jun Nakayama?" But rather than answering, I simply hung up and then retreated into the kitchen to make some tea.
Great. Thank you. Thank you. Yes. Good. I want to talk about voice in a minute. Lisa, will you read a little bit?
Okay, so this, I told you these are lovesick maidens, and this is Peony, who has been officially diagnosed as lovesick. You have to remember this was a real girl. And her mother has locked her in her room and stolen and burned all of her books in an effort to save her daughter from the perceived and truly perceived danger of reading and writing. Just as door after door was closing me in, my heart was opening wider and wider. I had no control over my activities, how I dressed, or my future life with the man my father had arranged for me to marry. But my emotions remained untrammeled and free. I've come to believe that part of lovesickness comes from this conflict between control and desire. In love, we have no control. Our hearts and minds are tormented, teased, enticed, and delighted by the overwhelming strength of emotions that makes us forget the real world. But that world does exist. So as women, we have to think about how to make our husbands happy by being good wives, bearing sons, running our households well, and being pretty so they don't become distracted from their daily activities or loiter with concubines. We are not born with these abilities. They must be instilled in us by other women. Through lessons, aphorisms, and acquired skills, we are molded and controlled. My mother controlled me through her instructions, even as she refused to see me. My aunts controlled... My aunts controlled me through their lessons. My future mother-in-law would control me after marriage. Together, these women, from the time I was born until the day I died, would control every single minute of my life. Yet for every effort at control, I was spinning away. At every moment, my poet invaded my thoughts. He was in my hair, my eyes, my fingers, my heart. I daydreamed about what he was doing, thinking, seeing, smelling, feeling. I could not eat for thoughts of him. Each time petal-scented air came through my window, my emotions were thrown into turmoil. As moonlight sent scattered shadows of bamboo leaves across my silk bedding, I dwelled in these dark thoughts. Sometimes I would get up, step over Shao, and go to the drawer where I kept the sprig of willow my poet had given me on our last night together. As the weeks went by, leaf after leaf fell away and crumbled to nothing, until all that was left was the twig. My little speck of a heart was soaked through with sadness.
So what interests me, such wonderful excerpts, thank you both so much. I'm interested in the choice of the first person for these books, both of you. You've both written in third person as well. I wondered if you might talk about that choice in the writing.
Go first. That gives me a moment to think.
Fair.
For me, in this book, it was a very conscious choice because part of, you know, as you can imagine, even though June at the beginning sounds like he doesn't want to deal with this guy, of course he really does, and he's flattered that he's getting this attention, but it sets off this whole set of sets of events and recollections going back to the silent film era in the teens and 20s. And for me, so much of this character is, speaking of control, is self-control, self-containment, and self-deception. Because what happened to end his career has to do partly with Hollywood, but has much more to do with anti-Japanese prejudice in the teens and 20s in California and in America in general, which is stuff he doesn't really want to deal with. He doesn't want to deal with that. He doesn't want to deal with the personal failings. And so he's constructed this very tight, you know, picture of who he is or what the story is. And so I really wanted to get right in the middle of that consciousness to show and to be able to show the reader how he's kind of fooling himself, and then also for the reader to be right in the middle of it when it started to fall apart and watch that awareness, watch that consciousness then have to incorporate all these things that were happening and make some sense of them. So it was going to be much more intimate, and I thought hopefully more like being on the actual ride if you were in that mind as it was having to deal with all of those things happening.
And you knew that from the get-go, that you were going to write in the first person. It wasn't a question of trying other things.
Oh, well, I had kind of a general sense of the era, of the character, and it just wasn't making any sense until I wrote the very first line.
And
I thought
that
that's the voice.
And was it easy to get back to it every day? Was it easy to get back into the voice, or did
yes, but then it became hard to, and I don't know what your experience is like, to keep that consistent for 300 plus pages.
Uh-huh.
You know, because I am a very informal, you know, foul-mouthed, regular kind of person, and so to, you know, the voice that speaks in a kind of, in a much more formal, gentlemanly way, even though I understood his psyche, that was a challenge for me. So sometimes I'd want to say things really colloquially, and then realize an elderly Japanese gentleman would not speak this way. So that was harder.
But checks and balances there.
Yes.
I'm gonna go backwards from there, which is, you know, writing about Chinese women in China in the past, there's so many words and phrases you can't use. You can't say things like, the feeling was electric, because they didn't have electricity,
right.
You know? So you have to be, so you can't say, oh, she was so naive, because, you know, naive, it's French, it's just too French. So you have to, I had to be so careful. I mean, I have to be so careful all the time. And it's tiring, that part, I think. And it's very kind of rigid. It's a rigid thing. With the first person, what I really like about it is, in some ways, you get to go very deeply into this one character and see what they're seeing and experience what they're feeling. And yet, you know, we're all liars. So these characters, they're unreliable. You know, they're not, they say one thing, but, you know, we all lie to ourselves, right? So why not lie to other people too? I mean, I think that there's something in this. So I think that that's really interesting, because along the way you get, the character is discovering his or herself. Now with Peony in Love, I first came across this story about the three wives and their connection to this opera back in 2000. I was asked by Vogue magazine, of all places, to write an article about the Chinese opera, the Peony Pavilion, that was being mounted at Lincoln Center. And, you know, I came across this whole, well, these lovesick maidens, and that they were part of this much larger phenomenon in China where there were, for this 30-year period, more women writers who were being published than all together in the rest of the world at that time. Well, of course, 1650, there weren't very many women being published in the rest of the world at that time, but in this one area, it was over 1,000 women writers who were being published, who were traveling. Well, I'm getting off the subject here. So I thought, well, you know, I thought this would make a really interesting story. And I thought of it originally as an opera, you know, these three wives. When I thought about it as a novel, though, to me, the fact that there were three of them was a real stumbling block. The, you know, how to do it. Well, the obvious way is first you tell this story, and then you tell the second wife, and then you tell the third one. I've never really liked that kind of book. Mm-hmm. You know, I've just never really liked it very much. And I think that there's sometimes too much overlap, like, okay, you know, Mary Beth thought this and interpreted it this way, and Jane has to cover that same material, but how she saw it. And I just don't like that form. It was when I was on the very last page writing Snowflower and the Secret Fan, and I don't know if any of you have read that, but it's an old woman who's writing about her life, hoping that this thing that she's writing will be burned so that the words will travel to the afterworld and serve as an apology to her best friend, her Lao Tong. And so serve as an apology to Snowflower. And as I wrote that sentence, I thought, I wonder how Snowflower would have told this story differently from the afterworld. And then I didn't want to write that over. You know, I didn't want to tell that Snowflower in the Secret Fan as, you know, Snowflower puts in her two cents. But I thought, well, that's how to tell this story of the three wives, to have one of them, that first wife who does die so early, but she could remain as a ghost and could talk from this Chinese afterworld, which is so different from our version of the afterworld. And again, you know, there's some really great things about writing in first person, some of them that we both talked about, but there are other aspects of it that are very difficult, because you can never really know what the other characters are thinking. You can only have that character think she knows or he knows.
Right, and you raised something very important, I think, here, the issue of the unreliable narrator, and I think that brings to mind the reader's responsibility. The reader is, after all, complicit. You know, we are only the writers. It's the reader that brings his or her own experience and temperament to the work. And I wonder if you could talk about what you expect from your readers if they read the way you expect them to read, if you've been surprised.
Oh my God, yes. I am so surprised all the time because people will interpret things in a way that I never expected.
In spite of your unreliable narrator.
Oh yeah, and actually with Peony in Love, I have so many people who will say to me, I put the book down when Peony died and I couldn't pick it up for another month because I was so mad at you for killing her. And then I just couldn't figure out what was going to happen next. And then other people who said, well, you know, I put it down and I never picked it up again, and don't do that again. I mean, really a lot of people who just said, once she died, I just wasn't going to read it. And they have all these reasons. I don't read ghost stories. That's not my belief. You know, all of these reasons. And yet, for me, as the writer, that part leading up to Peony's death, I knew I had to get through, because what I really wanted to write about was what happened after. Uh-huh. That, to me, is the story. So all that gooey part up at the beginning when she's, you know, 16 and in love and lovesick, I was just like, just get me through this, you know. but that's a part that people really love, and really a lot
of
people
are very invested.
And have had a hard time getting past that spot. So I gave something pretty major away about the plot there, but now you know.
So you can read the whole thing.
Yeah, so you can read the whole thing.
Nina, what about the unreliable narrator? What have you had people misunderstand June and his?
Sure, yeah. The vast majority the other way, that people get it. And I think it says something about their sensibility of you know, how much they understand their own processes of suppression or self-deception. Uh-huh. You know, and then, sometimes I went to one book group. And usually book groups are like love fests. I mean, you know, it's like, they love people, and they're wonderful. People love you. They love your books. They want to tell, you know, and I had just come off an amazing one where everybody got the book, you know. Then I went to one, I won't say where it was. And I don't know if it was because it's skewed much younger, but people were like, it wasn't clear whether he wanted to tell us stuff. Or, I mean, they just did not get the concept of why didn't he admit this until later? And I was like, well, he's an unreliable narrator, you know, and that was very interesting. So not the kind of violent reactions of I don't read ghost stories, but really not getting the device at all was kind of interesting. But that most people really do. So yeah, it was funny.
I wonder if there. I'd love you both to talk about what you are working on now, and if you're exploring a different kind of voice. If it's, would you do that? Would you talk to us a little bit about it, or is that to jinx the work? Or
doesn't bother me. I just I just turned in my next book last Monday, so I am so nervous waiting for the editor to call. It's driving me crazy. It's called Shanghai Girls. It starts in 1937 in Shanghai with two sisters who come to Los Angeles in arranged marriages. We had a lot of arranged marriages in my family. For example, my great uncle back in about 1932 took his whole family back to China. A lot of dads would say, you know, here's a little money, go buy a souvenir. He said, you know, as long as we're here, let's get all you boys wives. And that's what they did. And the oldest one was about 25. The youngest one was only 14. And these young women who in China had servants, once they came here, they became the servants. They had very, very hard lives. A couple of them are still living. You know, have lived here for 70 years and maybe speak 10 words of English. They never got out. They were never allowed out. When these two sisters come, at that time in Los Angeles, there were four Chinatowns. One of them was called China City. Does anyone remember China City? Yeah. One person remembers China City. It was developed by the same woman who developed Alvera Street, which, of course, is, you know, supposed to be an authentic Mexican marketplace. This was supposed to be an authentic Chinese city. It was just kitty corner from Alvera Street. One square block surrounded by a miniature Great Wall, and inside it was supposed to be an authentic Chinese city. It was built from the leftover sets from the filming of The Good Earth. So it wasn't too authentic, but it did have a certain charm. It was a really very sweet place, and it had several fires, and it finally closed down. But the one building that remained from China City is the place where my family had the store. Mm. So I, you know, feel in a way like I grew up in China City. Even though it was no longer China City. And finally, this is a story of sisters. And so in Snowflower and the Secret Fan, I was looking at Best Friends for Life and Peony and Love. There are these three sister wives, but also this relationship between the mother and Peony and her mother and grandmother, but now sisters. And sisters have a very unique relationship. This is the person who should stand by you and love you and support you no matter what. And yet, you know, your sister, you could be like, let's just say, in a motel shower, and you're minding your own business, taking a shower, and let's just say you're Janet Leigh in that shower, in that motel, and along comes your sister, you know, with the knife, because it's your sister who knows exactly where to drive the knife to hurt you the most. So I have had a good time with it, and sort of exploring that relationship of sisters, looking at that period of Los Angeles history, very much tied. That's why one of the reasons I was so fascinating reading The Age of Dreaming, because this book also has this Hollywood Chinese connection. China City really was the heart, in a sense, of where all of the Chinese extras came from. And so during the war, you know, all those war movies, everybody in them was Chinese because Japanese were off in the camps, and it was a whole scene.
Mm-hmm. And Nina, what are you working on?
Well, I'm working now again on have recently started another novel that's set in Los Angeles, but I just finished a short book. That's my first book not in Los Angeles, set in Wisconsin. Well, actually, the president is in Los Angeles, but the story is in Wisconsin. Uh-huh. And it's kind of the setup is pretty autobiographical, the most autobiographical since my first book, in that it concerns a young mixed-race Japanese and white kid who's picked up from Japan and brought to this tiny town, living with her Midwestern grandparents, and then a black family moves into and faces a lot of racism. And then a black family moves into town to work at the clinic, and all hell breaks loose. So it was a way for me to explore race in a different setting, uh-huh. formation of identity, but also, I really try to make every book very different. It's more challenging for me. It's kind of interesting to do that. And I have a real love for books that kind of counterintuitively are kind of some of the great set in nature, short, beautiful, clean prose things. Things like, I loved A River Runs Through It. Norman MacLean, it's one of my very favorite books. It's only 100 pages long. Or Larry Watson's Montana 1948, or some of Wendell Berry's fiction. And there's something about the, nature and descriptions of people in relation to the outside, but also the way that things function in a smaller area, that was really interesting to me. And it's kind of like moving my racial and community and family concerns into a different kind of petri dish, if that uh-huh. makes sense, but uh-huh. with the beginning and end still in LA. So that was, so the story that happens is completely, fictional and terrible and sad and, all those great things that we both like to do. But in a slight, and I also wanted to try and write a shorter book. So.
I would like to ask you about, both of you, what inspires you, what you're reading, what sorts of art you're interested in. But before I do that, I am both of you are great storytellers. Both of you have written mysteries, sort of not genre fiction per se, but you have a series, actually, a mystery series, and your books have that very strong narrative, that urgent narrative through line. Can you talk a bit about that, how you feel about the narrative line, the idea that a story needs to have some momentum?
I'm looking at her.
Okay. As a reader, and I think as a human person, I love, that's redundant. Not an inhuman person, but I love to be told stories. I love to be caught up in a narrative with strong characters, with interesting situations that takes me somewhere. And it doesn't have to necessarily be a traditional beginning, middle, end. It can be played with, but I want to feel like I've taken some kind of journey and that at the end of it, I'm moved or changed in some way. And that is something, the whole storytelling function that I think in some ways is not so emphasized in a lot of contemporary fiction and is almost looked down upon. I had a contemporary, we were talking about graduate writing programs, and I was in one, 10, 12 years ago, who actually said to us, if you really like, traditional narrative, it means you're stupid. And, I want to feel like, Emily Dickinson's term, like the top of my head is taken off. And, uh-huh. and I think that if you have a compelling story, whether it's in a, you've talked a little bit about the kind of mystery arc or some other, what's going to happen next structure, that it almost enables you to sneak in or to build in all kinds of other stuff that people might not want to read otherwise. Uh-huh. If you talk about, I've written a social history set in the Crenshaw District of Los Angeles, exploring, the African American and Japanese American community. How boring.
Sure, or foot binding.
Foot binding. Yeah, I wrote a book about foot binding. Like that's it. Of course, I'm exaggerating for effect here, but these things are dealt with in the context, hopefully, of characters and plot that are interesting enough that they'll make people go along for the uh-huh. for the ride. And it's one of the things that I really love about your work, Lisa. That it's you. Yes, there's all this important history and social industrial relations, and but it is just amazing what you're able to do in the course of the book. The way that the characters change, the unexpected ways that kind of roles, you know, reverse. And you finish that book. We were talking about endings before, and you just feel like, oh my, you know, I read a book.
Yeah, it's satisfying. Very satisfying.
Yeah, exactly.
I agree. That's true, I think, of both of your books, that it's very satisfying to come to the end. I'm afraid I might have to...
No, you got to let her in.
No, I agree 100% with everything Nina said. I mean, totally.
No.
I don't have anything to add, because that's what I probably would have said if I'd thought about it for a little while.
Will you just talk for a minute about... because Nina was talking about what she likes to read. Will you tell us what you're reading, what inspires you, where you go?
I don't read very much, actually, when I'm writing. Uh-huh. I mean, I read almost nothing when I'm writing. Except for when I'm except for when I'm done editing, like between books. So this last week, you know, I got to read. And I'm reading, let's see, I read The Gathering.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I liked it. I mean, actually, my favorite book that I've read recently is The Age of Dreaming. I've been recommending it everywhere. I love it. I just love it. The reason I don't read fiction, and I'm sure maybe you don't feel the same way, but I feel a little bit like I have to be very careful. I don't want those other voices in my head. I don't want that author's voice in my head, and it's a little bit like being an athlete and not having sex or whatever. You have to kind of protect yourself from what you allow to come in. And so I, you know, when I was writing Peony in Love, I read a lot of poetry by these 17th century women writers. For Shanghai Girls, I was reading a lot of poetry and short stories by women in China in the 1930s. Mm-hmm. So I'm happy to sort of immerse myself in that time, whatever the time period is. But otherwise, I'm reading these really, you know, esoteric, unpublished dissertations on really things you just think, really? Somebody spent 10 years on this? But I read it, so, you know, I read it, and then I sort of distill it and put it in here, and put it in these books. And I just to go sort of back to your that last question, I think why I like writing historical novels is that with my first book, On Gold Mountain, which is about my family, a nonfiction book, in that process, I saw that history is something that happens to individual people. Well, this is a pretty obvious thing, but this is not how we learn history. We learn history in terms of wars and dates, but history is something that happens to individual people. It happened to my family. It happened to your families. It's happening to all of us as we're sitting in this room right now. And so what is so interesting is, do people rise to the occasion or do they fall? And I saw this in my own family, and you can see it everywhere. It's, you know, given these cards, how are you going to play them? Mm-hmm. And there is so much in history and in place that is fascinating, and what happens to people in that history and in those places. But you may not want to read that book. I mean, you may not want to read a book about... the building of the Three Gorges Dam. I'm thinking of some of the books I've written, you know, the building of the Three Gorges Dam, or how American goods are made in Chinese factories. But if there's a murder on page one, you're going to want to read to the end to find out who did it. And so along the way, you can put in all of this other stuff.
Right. Absolutely. I think that you seem to be, forgive me, on the same page there. I would love to open this up to all of you now. I think there's a microphone floating around. Yes, up there. And if you'd use the mic when you ask your questions so that everybody can hear you and so that it works for, you know, posterity. Are there questions from people, readers? Yes, please. Sorry.
This is to Miss Say. Could you talk a little bit about what influence, if any, your mother has on your writing and your relationship
Yes,
as writers with her?
Certainly. My mother is Carolyn C. She is an incredible writer, and she's an even more incredible mother. And she has been a huge influence on me. As you must know, we write about very, very different things. We have very different writing styles. But our writing routines and our methods are identical. I mean, really close. 1,000 words a day. You know, that's it. Just 1,000 words a day. And two charming notes. And, you know, this is what I watched her doing, and which she still does today, and it's what I do and what I know. We talk every day, at least once a day. I don't think we have a very traditional mother-daughter relationship, but we do have this incredible relationship about writing. And so we talk about what we're writing, what's working, what isn't working. That, you know, damn editor in New York, he's driving me crazy. Well, you know, and then I'll calm her down, or she'll calm me down. And, you know, you'll get through it. And so, or places where you get stuck and you think, oh, I'm in the, you know, here I have this, you know. So anyway, so it's really, I think our relationship is really very tied to the writing. And I'm just so lucky to have her as a mother. And, you know, my mother's father was a writer as well, so we're three generations of writers, and I'm just very lucky that he wasn't a plumber.
Thank you. There was a question right down here in front. Yes, wait for this microphone, it's coming to you.
I enjoyed hearing about all the influences on your writing. Having tried to read Chinese or Japanese literature, I haven't tried to read the more modern type. I'm wondering whether your work seemed to be grounded in Western forms, and I'm wondering if there's a big difference between the Chinese and Japanese. And for example, trying to read The Tale of Genji was, you know, not if that's how you pronounce it, not easy. And so you seem to be, in your own personal identity, feeling more of your Eastern heritage, but in your writing, putting your books together, seeming to be more in the Western tradition. I was just wondering if you could talk about any Chinese or Japanese influences on your writing.
I can answer very quickly for myself, and then for you, then you should do it. The form is definitely Western for me, but then it's what do you take from that Eastern form, or, you know, Chinese literature, words, phrases. With Snowflower and the Secret Fan, you know, this is about a secret writing system that was invented and used by women. It was written in rhyme, and it had only 5 syllables a line. Well, I couldn't have done that. You know, I couldn't write a novel that way. Nobody would want to read it. But what you can do is try to capture the essence of that, and sometimes the rhythms. And that book has very short sentences, very, very simple words, because the language of Nushu only had 600 characters. So they were very limited, even in their writing, what they could write about. So, you know, there are ways that you kind of, but it's in, for me anyway, it's in the words and in the rhythm and in the imagery.
Yeah, I think that's correct. I have read some older Japanese literature, but certainly the big influences on me are more Western. But particularly for this book and this voice, there's so much else about Japanese culture and history that informed him. I mean, it just the other characters are Japanese American. This guy is Japanese living in America. And so viewing the world through his particular lens, which is actually kind of more like my mother's. She is actually a 71-year-old Japanese woman living in America, not Japanese American. And so I think that almost, you know, partly the time that I spent there, both as a child and an adult, but also just having been around Japanese adults, not Japanese American adults, but Japanese adults, and the way that they view the world, the way that they interact with the world, is in every little way. You know, my mother, for example, I will spare you the details, but talking about, like, you know, wardrobe malfunctions backstage. But my mother, you know, her aesthetic for how people, she thinks that Americans dress terribly, you know, and is always giving me hell about it, or the way that food is presented in restaurants, or the way that people treat each other on the street. Like her, even though she's lived here for 20 years or so, it is just, you know, she is still very Japanese in the way she sees the world. And so all of that really plays into this voice particularly.
In fact, just to interject, there's Nina does a wonderful thing in this book where she turns the lens on June when he has his screen test. And you have this sense, and this is a case of the unreliable narrator, where you have the sense of this incredibly elegant, articulate gentleman throughout the book, and then she lets us see him from the point of view of some rather mediocre Americans. So it's fascinating. It's fascinating that she does this. Another question, anywhere. Yes, right here down front. Wait for that mic.
Kind of a question in two parts, Nina. What prompted you to want to bring or inject June into the William Desmond Taylor case? And also, in terms of names of characters, many of the stars are their actual names, but then there's some that appear to be, you've changed the name of a real historical figure. How did that come about?
Well, okay, for those of you who don't know, there are two factual kind of pillars upon which this story is built. One is the still unsolved murder of a director, and the other, there actually was a Japanese silent film star, Sesue Hayakawa. And I have a day job working for a nonprofit. I work in the building that was the home of Mary Miles Minter. And so that's how I got fascinated with the era. I would be sitting in the building late at night and thinking, you know, wow, this is what, I have pictures of what it looked like in 1921 when she lived there. So that was very, very interesting to me. I was not primarily, you know, this relates to what we were talking about. I was not primarily interested in the murder story. What I was really interested in at that point was finding a way to write about what was happening to me at that point in my life. And again, you know, going back to, I had written my second book. I was getting, you know, going through 2 years of rejection for that book. And I sat down and wondered, what would I feel like if I were 73, 75, and I never wrote another book? And so that was really the way that I, you know, I was fascinated by the idea of Hayakawa for a second. I'll get to in a second, but that was really the emotional impetus, is trying to project, you know, my own sense of failure and regret if I just gave up. So June's career, his film career, ends when he was 30, the way that my writing career, I thought, which is so, don't hit me, right? I thought it was done when I was 30, you know? So that was the real way in. But in addition to that, historically, I was fascinated by the idea that in real life, there had been a Japanese actor who was a huge star and a sex symbol in 1915, at a time when Japanese were living in completely segregated, you know, situations here in California, when in Congress, people were pushing for a complete exclusion, when kids in San Francisco, Japanese kids were being kicked out of public schools, and I was very fascinated by the idea of what does it cost someone to become famous in the context, this is the part that is not autobiographical, to become famous in a or to have success in a world where people really don't approve of what you are. What does it cost you psychically, professionally, emotionally to achieve success, you know, and make the kind of compromises that you do? So that was really, you know, he was kind of a vehicle for me. And, of course, the real-life Hayakawa went on to have a very successful career even after World War II and as an older man, whereas my guy, you know, stops making films when he's 30 and, you know, never appears again. So that's why it really was a personal way for me to find a way to tell my own story, if that makes sense.
Do I have time to take one more? No? One more. One more question. Anybody? Wave at me because I can't really see you. Great. Yes, thanks.
I wanted to go back to something that you had actually asked them earlier that we got kind of sidetracked and I didn't hear about, and that is that they seem to be much more influenced by their Asian heritage. Uh-huh. And don't really talk from the perspective of their Caucasian heritage.
Yes, I am fascinated by that as well.
And so I would like to hear from each of you, you know, do you have plans to perhaps explore that aspect of your heritage?
I don't. You know, and again, I think this goes, I felt like we did answer that, that, you know, how do you see yourself? You know, how do you identify yourself? It's by the people you see around you. And
but I think the part two, do you ever plan to? And, that, and that's
right,
a good
but
answer.
I, yeah, I don't, I mean, I, because it's not the part that's terribly interesting to me. I know, you know, and my mother, that can, my mom writes that stuff, so, you know, let her do it. When I can remember at one point saying, you know, I'm talking to her on the phone saying, can I just have China? And she's like, knock yourself out, you know. So I think, you know, for me personally, there is that kind of a line where then we you know, we don't compete, but this is a nice area for me to write in, and it is what I'm personally interested in. That.
And Nina?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you can only write the stuff that really compels you. The stories that you want to tell, the things that you find a connection to in some way. So, you know, I'm not going to make a point of, you know, I need to cover this part of myself. You know, it's a reach for me, even in the book I just finished, to have a mixed
half
race.
And half, yeah.
Yeah, mixed race character. And that I was willing to do because it, you know, that was interesting to me, particularly in that setting.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, but you can only write about what interests you.
Right, and it's not only what interests you, but where you are in your life at that moment. Just like you were talking about just a minute ago, I had, my mysteries were out of print for quite a while, and they came back in January. Now I don't sit around and read my old books, I don't. But when they came and they had these really nice new covers, I couldn't help it, I opened them up. And I opened, and it was interesting that whatever page I opened, and just randomly, I knew exactly where I was in my life emotionally when I wrote that page. Because even though on the surface I think these books don't look like they're our lives, in fact, our lives are completely in there. Emotionally, that emotional aspect. Mm-hmm. That was such a revelation mm-hmm. for me. Because I hadn't really, you know, had... Because when you're writing it, sometimes it's deliberate. But often you don't realize how much of your daily life and that your emotional landscape is seeping in and how much you're sort of working through these things.
Just as the reader brings his or her life and emotional landscape to the read, and I encourage all of you to read these authors. It's a treat, it's revelatory, it's exciting. I'm so glad you came today. Thank you very much. It's been an honor and a privilege. Thank you.
Thank you.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.